May it please the court, my honorable opponents, I'm Blaine Myrie, counsel for appellants in this case. In McIntyre versus Board of County Commissioners, the Supreme Court clarified the law governing the creation of public roads by prescription under 43.2.2011C of the statutes. The Supreme Court emphasized in that case that the requirement of adversity and the requirement of a claim of right are separate requirements that a claimant must prove in order to prevail on his claim. Here, the trial court misapplied the requirements of McIntyre in concluding that the legal tender road and the last chance road were public by prescription. I'd like to address both the adversity requirement and the overt act requirement, which is part of the claim of right requirement. And I'd also like to address the resolutions if there's time. But before I do that, I want to emphasize in this case that there are two separate roads at issue, the legal tender road and the last chance road, and that there are two separate properties at issue that those roads cross. The legal tender road crosses the legal tender claim, and the last chance road crosses the Domingo claim. And I think that's important for the court to bear in mind in its analysis. Now, in McIntyre, the Supreme Court emphasized that the establishment of a public road by prescription is a narrow alternative to the other means public entities have for establishing a road. The court stressed in that case that the General Assembly has encouraged landowners in Colorado to allow the public to use their land, and in turn the General Assembly has guarded against landowners losing their property rights when allowing such public use. And because of that, travel over vacant land is deemed permissive and cannot serve as the predicate of a prescriptive right. The presumption of adversity thus does not apply where land is vacant. Here, the trial court's error was in applying the presumption of adversity when it based on a clearly erroneous finding that the land at issue, the Domingo claim and the legal tender claim, was not vacant or unoccupied.
Mr. Myrie, I'd like to just clarify what was argued in the trial court, and I know I understand you are not trial counsel.
Right.
The court's findings include finding 61, plaintiffs assert this arises, use of the roads, arises out of an unwritten, express, or implied mutual agreement or understanding of all their predecessors entitled that mining claim owners and operators could use the roads by mutual consent. Now, this is it also your understanding that that was plaintiff's argument for permissive use?
That was an argument for permissive use back in the mining days, because frankly, there was a lot of mining activity going on, but the position was always that it was a permissive use. But there's an additional requirement beyond simply an agreement of permission. There is a requirement under McIntyre that adversity be shown. And in this case, the trial court found the presumption of adversity applied based on its conclusion that the land was not vacant or unoccupied.
Okay, if I could return to my question, I'd like to know where in the trial court the plaintiffs argued that that presumption could not apply because the land was vacant and unoccupied.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that that was argued, but frankly, it doesn't need to be argued because it's not an issue of preservation. It's an issue of the trial court applying McIntyre correctly. And McIntyre requires the adversity requirement to be proved by the public entity claim. And part of that proof is a presumption of adversity if the land is not vacant or unoccupied. So there is a prerequisite to the presumption of adversity that the claimant must show. And what the claimant must show is that the land is vacant, or is not vacant, but is occupied and not vacant during the prescriptive period. And that makes sense from the standpoint of what McIntyre stands for, and that is the claim of right requirement is something that puts the landowner on notice. And where you have vacant land and a public policy favoring the public travel across land, the vacant landowner is not going to be put on notice unless there is an overt act that is clear and unequivocal and puts that owner on notice.
Now, but the trial, pardon me for interrupting, the trial court did make a finding that the land was not vacant.
Right.
Are you contending that that was a clearly erroneous finding?
Absolutely. There is no evidence in the record that the legal tender claim or the Domingo claim, which are the two claims at issue, in which plaintiff or the county has to prove were occupied and not vacant, there's no evidence in the record that during the prescriptive period, those were ever occupied. If you look at the evidence they rely on, they rely on 1 to 2 minors living in Bachelor. If you look at the map, the Bachelor town site is significantly south where these claims lie. The legal tender claim lies right at the start, the northern start of the legal tender road. The Domingo claim lies right at the start, the northern start of the last chance road. The Bachelor town site is well below those. So their proof of occupancy consists of two minors living somewhere else in the 1960s. They also refer to a cabin on the property. Well, the cabin was built by Mr. Ormsby, who didn't acquire the claims until 1994. And that cabin's not even on the Domingo claim.
Could you give me an idea, Mr. Meyer, how big are these claims? I mean, I don't even know if it's in the record, but I don't know what a mining claim is.
Well, Your Honor, there are maps in the record. There's a large oversized map, which I believe is Exhibit LL. And I don't know if it's the defense or interviewer's exhibit, but that shows the mining claims essentially in the Creed camp vicinity. But in terms of the size of them, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, candidly, looking at mining claims on a map is something beyond my eyes.
And as an aside, I'm sure my colleagues agree, and we appreciate from both parties having the colored map to look at, because
I think we all agree that it's important. That's the difficulty in this case, is we're trying to add a certain amount of precision to the analysis here that, you know, the parties, the miners, weren't thinking about in 1890 when they first plotted this out. But the issue here then is there adequate proof that the land was not vacant and it was occupied during the prescriptive period? The prescriptive period here is the 1950s to 1980s. There is no alleged overt act that they can point to that occurs before that period. The trial court, in error, relied on an overt act of the placement of these roads on a USGS survey map in 1910. The problem with that is not an act of the county. And McIntyre makes clear that it is the public entity claimant that has to commit the overt act or engage in the conduct that constitutes an overt act. The U.S. Geological Survey is not the county, and so that map can't apply. Moreover, with regard to the legal tender road, the court made a finding in the record that the legal tender road was not even a continuous road until sometime between 1927 and the 1950s, and that's at page, that's finding 74, one of the subparagraphs of finding 74. So the legal tender road is not even a continuous road until after the mining boom and bust is gone, until most likely after the treasurer's deed issue. So in looking at the prescriptive period, they point to what I would call sporadic maintenance of the road at the request of miners. In the 1950s through into the 1980s, where it was there was testimony and a finding by the trial court that these roads were maintained or plowed once a year. In a mountainous community like Creed that's going to get a lot of snowfall, I'd submit that a plowing of a road once a year is not the county exercising a claim of right, particularly when it was done at the request of the mine owners to keep the mines open. That is some of the case law in our briefs illustrate, that is not sufficient to establish a claim of right. Moreover, even if that did establish a claim of right, we still have the problem of no showing of adversity because the land was not demonstrated to be occupied and not vacant during the prescriptive period. And as McIntyre says, in those circumstances, it is the use, the public use, no matter how extensive, is deemed permissive. And that's what we have here. We have permissive use of the roads across vacant, unoccupied land. That's not sufficient to give rise to a public road by prescription.
Counsel, pardon me for interrupting. I want to make sure I have time for you to ask you and have you answer this question. I'm confused about takings, because in your opening brief, you make reference to takings, and then in your reply brief, you say there really wasn't a takings claim. And you can see why I'm confused about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was some of the confusion. It was really how the issue was argued in the district court. The claim that was brought was a declaratory judgment claim to assert that the resolutions in the road tabulation was invalid. And in that context, the argument was raised that, you know, if the road tabulation is not just an inventory, but is attempt to create roads, then it constitutes a taking. But it wasn't a takings claim. It is instead a claim that the relief sought is to have the resolutions and tabulations declared invalid. And the basis for the declaration that they're invalid is that the open meetings law 24.6402 wasn't complied with, as we noted in our opening brief. And if you look at the evidence in the record, it's pretty clear that the resolution 98.6, which is the key resolution, because that's what led to the creation and adoption of the road tabulation, that there were no formal hearings on that resolution. And with regard to the road tabulation, the evidence in the record is from Commissioner Kolish, was that at the time of the adoption of the road tabulation, there wasn't any opportunity for anyone to object to any of the tabulations. So the problem with the road tabulations and the resolutions is that they were adopted in violation of the Colorado Sunshine Law, specifically the open meetings portion of that statute.
Now, what do you do about the fact that the court found that to be a quasi-judicial ruling and that you missed the deadline to appeal?
There's two answers to that. First, if it only created an inventory, then how is it adjudicating any rights, in which case it shouldn't be considered quasi-judicial, it should be considered legislative or quasi-legislative, in which case the time limit in 106 doesn't apply. And if it is quasi-judicial, then the problem is notice, and relying on the Regenerative case that we cited in our brief. In order for a 106 action to be triggered, the 30-day period to be triggered, the public, the parties who would be affected have to have notice. And here we don't have any notice. The resolution wasn't even recorded until 2006. So under the Regenerative claim, we submit the 30-day limit cannot apply because of a lack of notice. And that I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. You have about 2 minutes and 26 seconds remaining.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Heidi Potter, attorney registration number 30301. I represent Mineral County in this action. With me here today is the Mineral County attorney, Randall Nicholson, and at council table with me is Charles Powers, who represented the interveners at the trial court, Jack Morris.
Are you going to split your time, or are you going to?
We are not just going to get that. I've agreed with Mr. Powers that I will take 13 minutes and he will take 2 to address a couple of issues that are unique to his client, but the arguments that I make are applicable to both. So with that in mind, going. We request that you affirm the holding below. And I want to hit 2 points if I can, and they're the 2 points that you discussed already with Mr. Myrie. First, the record amply supports the trial court's finding that the legal tender and last chance roads are public by prescription. There's no clear error here, and I think we need to avoid what the Lincoln case cited by plaintiffs says, and that is getting lost in a tree of presumptions and overlooking the forest, which is proof of adverse and permissive use and how those two things work together. The sufficiency of the evidence, as I said here, does not indicate a clear error, and we'll get to that in a minute. And second, the trial court's findings that these roads were public by prescription negates the plaintiff's claim that the county resolutions and tabulations are invalid, and this case was indeed framed with a takings claim, and I'll get to that if I have time. I want to go to this issue first of prescriptive rights and presumptions and what was being argued here this morning. Plaintiffs concede in their reply brief that they did not make any vacant land argument in the trial court, and in fact, they did not. Most tellingly, they did not make such an argument in their closing argument or in their proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. What they say instead is, well, we didn't have to prove that. I would submit to this court that that is contrary to the requirement that they build a record so that this court can make a determination that is fair to all the parties and can look at what the court actually decided. There is no developed record on this issue because the plaintiffs did not make an issue of it.
Could you address a little, stay on that point just a moment. Mr. Myrie, I believe, has suggested that because it was part of the county's burden to establish the McIntyre requirements, they didn't have to raise the issue. Would you?
Sure. I disagree that it isn't their burden of proof, and I'll get to that in a minute. But even if it was their burden of proof, they are obligated at trial to say, we didn't meet our burden of proof. They never argued that we didn't meet our burden of proof for this reason. And they argued a permissive use theory, which is entirely contrary to the one that they're now urging, which is probably one of the reasons that they didn't argue that they get an exception. What they argued below was that all the mining owners had an express or implied some sort of tacit agreement to allow one another to use the portions of a road that crossed their property. And I'll give you a couple of record sites where they made that argument. It was in their summary judgment briefing, also in motion limiting. And you can find that at PDF pages 548, 1486, 1488, and 1774. That argument included, as presented by them, all of the properties that were up there, including the legal tender claims and the Domingo claims. Well, how can you say on the one hand that they all had an agreement and everybody knew what everybody else was doing, and now say, oh no, the property's vacant, we have no idea because we weren't out there to see what was going on? Those two things are contrary to one another. Those two things are two different theories of permissive use, but they did not forward this vacant land theory of permissive use at trial. And I again submit that they have to do that regardless of who carries that burden. And if you look at their briefs, they argue that we didn't meet our burden of proof on a number of different issues and for a number of different reasons, but suddenly now they claim they don't have to argue that we didn't meet our burden of proof on this issue. I think that that is because they didn't raise it below. Now going to this question of, do we carry the burden of proof? We've argued in our briefs, and I would submit that we do not carry that burden of proof. As I just discussed, the vacant land exception is another theory of permissive use. And if you look into case law throughout, it is common that the adverse presumption arises first, and that's proved by 20 years of uninterrupted use by the party claiming the right. Then the other burden shifts to the other party to prove permissive use. That then can rebut the presumption. The burdens can then shift again, and now you can rebut the permissive use with additional testimony.
Is there a particular authority on which you're relying? And I realize you saw your cases in the briefs.
Sure, we've cited a number of cases, but McIntyre itself refers to this vacant land exception as a permissive use type of argument. They frame it that way. There are a number of cases that we've cited where that burden shifts, I will look at it. There are three. We cited Weisinger, Allen, and Keith. All of those cases discuss the shifting burden. We also cited other cases that talk about the fact, and the Barker case is one of these, that these are not conclusive burdens. These are rebuttable presumptions. A presumption isn't some magic bullet that means if you meet the presumption, it can't be rebutted. If that were the case, there'd be no reason for the McIntyre holding. It would simply end the discussion. If this was vacant land, it could never be adversely possessed. But that's not what McIntyre says. What McIntyre says is, we have a concern. We have a vacant land exception concern because we don't want to encourage people on the one hand to use property that's open and unenclosed and then turn around and say, oh, but it's ours. But the way that they protected against that concern was by adding the public claim of right requirement. And the public claim of right requirement requires proof that the county went out and did something in addition to the general public use that had been occurring on the property over the last 20 years.
So if there's a public claim of right, are you saying that somehow trumps or gets rid of the vacant land piece?
I think that it can be rebuttable evidence to the vacant land exception. And if you look at the cases that have discussed this, Box Steel is a great example. It's a Court of Appeals case that occurred post-McIntyre. They looked at all those issues and they weighed the facts back and forth on all of that in addition to the public claim of right. And those things taken together, that totality of the evidence is what ultimately leads to a conclusion whether a road is public or whether it's not. The other thing I think it's important to point out here is the case law, and if you look at the cases, Simon is one of these cases, Fox-Steagall is one of these cases. The fact of the matter is that vacant land doesn't end the inquiry. In Simon, for instance, it was undisputed that parties had stipulated that this vacant lot at issue there was vacant, unoccupied, and unenclosed. Supreme Court came and looked at that and they said, I realize you stipulated, we're not going to decide this case on that issue. We're going to look at this in terms of whether or not a footpath is a road. But in dicta, they then continue to say, we note that we don't need to go to the issue of whether or not the vacant land exception applies, but the property owner lived nearby, and we think that likely was a problem for maintaining the vacant land exception. That's proof that even if property is vacant, that presumption can be overcome. Similar cases in the Garfield WHI case and also in the Box-Steagall case, the court looked at the fact that people were living in the area, that people were living nearby or across the street, that there were other people that were on the property occasionally, irrigate property, or a sheep herder passed by. All of those facts were significant to a determination that even if the property was vacant, it was not unoccupied, or that permissive use theory shouldn't apply under the circumstances.
This goes back to the question I put to Mr. Myrie. I don't know if a mining claim is as big as this courtroom or many acres, but can you enlighten me on that first? And so what I hear you saying is that if there was activity in the area, people living in the area, whether they were specifically on that claim doesn't matter.
That's right. In certain circumstances, sure. That could be the instance. I don't know. I think all of these vary over the years when I've done different real estate work and seeing these crazy mining claims. They're very funky and they can have very different size. But I think 10 acres is probably a reasonable size. That's not in the record. I'm simply responding to your question on that point. But I think you can look at the pictures, the historic pictures that are there, and also look at the way these mining claims laid out. The cabins that they're talking about that Mr. Frank's predecessor in interest put on the property in the 90s, those are just across the street from the parcels that they're claiming are vacant and unimproved. I think you can see there that would be inequitable to say, well, they're vacant, so therefore they can never be possessed. You have to look at all those facts, and that's what the court did.
But if those were put up in the 90s, that wouldn't bear
on. No, it's not during the prescriptive period, but it goes to the point that those are the types of things that courts weigh. And here the court clearly found this was a center of commerce, this was a center of activity, there were people in and around all these claims for at least 30 years from the period of time in which the county contends that the prescriptive rights claim began to run. I want to get to that issue because it's important. It's this maintenance issue. And my opponent wants to say that there wasn't enough maintenance. First of all, maintenance, and as it's described in the cases, if you look over the history of the Colorado cases that deal with maintenance, there is no telltale rule. It's a case-by-case basis when something is enough maintenance or not. Here, and I want to correct this testimony, it was not snowplowed once a year, it was maintained once a year. They would come through in the spring to clear out sloughing and other stuff that had come down onto the road during the winter. They plowed as necessary, so I don't want that to get lost. And there were clear findings of that maintenance and that it was regular, that it went on for a period of years, and also that this road didn't require a lot of maintenance. Well, because something doesn't require a lot of maintenance shouldn't mean that you can't prove maintenance because you only maintain it as required or needed. So maintenance clearly occurred here and started that clock ticking. And that maintenance is that protective piece, this public claim of rights. That's why the Supreme Court added that, and McIntyre wanted to make sure that everybody understood the proof of that. That protects against the vacant land exception. It protects against other types of situations like that, where you could see that you would never know that the public itself was claiming, that the county itself was claiming. And here there are a number of different pieces supporting that. I do want to get very quickly to this issue of the takings claim. If you look at their complaints, if you look at the trial management order, if you look at their summary judgment briefing, and most importantly, look at the court's summary judgment order, this was all framed as a takings claim. That's how it all came down. And what the court said in its summary judgment order is, I find that you don't have any 106A4 rights. Those have long since run. It's been 8 years since these things were enacted. And the types of complaints that you're making are 106A4 type claims. It's that the county abused its discretion, went beyond the scope of what it's allowed to do in these procedures. And the trial court said, you're not going to get to put that on. And the plaintiffs have not appealed that here. What he did say was, but I find that the case law provides that in certain circumstances you can have a Rule 57 claim, for instance, to advance a constitutional claim. And then he noted that the constitutional claim that had been pressed here by the plaintiffs was a takings claim, and that they could go forward with proof on that. They did not bring an open meetings law claim. They did not bring an open records act claim. They did not bring even a procedural due process claim. And those are the types of cases that they're pointing to in the statutes that they're citing. What they brought was a takings claim. They said, when you enacted these regulations, you took our property. And I don't think they can escape that now. They didn't put on proof of damages and not just that claim. And if there's prescriptive use, they didn't have an interest in the property, so there can be no takings claim. I need to give the rest of my time here to counsel. Thank you for hearing our case. We ask that you affirm.
Good morning, I'm Charles Powers. I'm representing Mr. Morris, and my attorney number is 7618. I just wanted to clarify that the last chance mine, which is talked about quite a bit and is lays across the last chance road and the New York mining claim, are landlocked and they are accessed only by the roads that we're discussing here and that were involved in this case, so that if Mr. Morris supports everything that the trial court did and supports the arguments that were just made, but I wanted to bring to your attention that if you were to reverse this order, you would set aside the entire order, and the lower court found that it was not necessary to get to Mr. Morris's private right to use those roads, even though it was agreed he had a private right. There was a disagreement of the extent of his private right, how much traffic, and that sort of thing. So if you set aside the court's order, which inherently included this determination he did not need to get to the private issue because the public solved all of our request for relief, that would necessarily go and that issue would be back on the table for determination. So I don't want to leave Mr. Morris without relief. And that's very important. But we believe that the order was correct. And I would just say briefly that the plaintiffs argued that they knew about these roads from the beginning, they intended these roads, and that now they're arguing that, well, later, 50 years after we used them and left them there and had them there for the public, that we may have forgot about them and we didn't know the public was using them. That's an absurd argument. Makes no sense, and it's contrary to what they argued earlier, and what you pointed out is in the order. And also that...
Thank you, counsel. I see that your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel pointed out the box dealer case. I think the box dealer case is very instructive when it comes to how this court should analyze the vacant land situation. In that case, this court said, with regard to what the trial court did there, that, and this is at page is 97 P3rd at 330. Here, there is evidence to support the trial court's conclusion that the relevant land was not vacant, unenclosed, and unoccupied. And so the trial court properly applied the presumption of adverse use. So I think the Box-Steagall case essentially says if the presumption of diversity applies if the trial court makes a proper finding that the land is not vacant or unoccupied. The problem is that here the trial court made that finding But that finding is not supported by the record. It was clearly erroneous. There is no evidence in the record. We heard again about the cabin that was built in the 1990s. We don't have evidence, we don't have testimony from any of the people who testified at trial who lived in Creed in the 1950s. They talked about using the road. They absolutely talked about using the roads and some of the work that they did there. But you never hear the testimony, and this is the key point, you never hear the testimony from them that so-and-so lived on the Domingo claim, or so-and-so owned this claim and the Domingo claim and occupied it. We don't have that. We have nothing in the record to show what was going on the Domingo claim and the legal tender claim from the time of the treasurer's deed in 1928 up until Mr. Ormsby acquired the property in 1994. And he actually acquired the Domingo claim in 2000. There just isn't, they refer to the Flickinger case and other cases where there is evidence to support what the trial court did. The problem here is with the vacant land issue, there simply isn't evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding. That means that the trial court erroneously applied the presumption of adversity. And I agree that they could still show that the use was adverse, but there's no evidence of that. They have no evidence to show that during the 1950s to 1980s, they were using the land and roads adverse to the owners. There simply isn't evidence that the record supported.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your briefing and arguments. We appreciate them very much. The case will now stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.